UK Wine Show, show number 90. Otago Wine Region with Peregrine owner Greg Hay. On this week's show,
of the wineries that did exist, there were 10 in Marlborough, and we felt that even though that was closer to our hometown, that was actually quite crowded.
And in the news this week, Jacobs Creek to lower alcohol content, Australia defend their carbon footprint, and Marks & Spencer launch Pink Port.
G'day! Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 90 for the 8th of February 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and this week we're talking with Greg Hay from Peregrine Winery in Otago on Central Otago Wine Region. I mentioned back in show 85 I'd be putting this one out. It's a bit longer than normal, but if you're into New Zealand wines, then Central Otago is definitely the current hottest region in New Zealand. I do need to get something up front. I'm from Otago, well, Dunedin to be precise, so I am a bit biased, but do bear with me. There are some cracking wines coming out of Otago, and it's not just the Pinot Noirs as well. There's some quite respectable Rieslings coming out, and with experiments in Sauvignon Blanc and Chardonnay, the world is looking pretty good if you're an Otago producer. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Jacobs Creek is planning to lower the alcohol level of its wines so that none exceed 14%. This will mean a reduction of around 0.5% to 1% of alcohol on some of their wines. They have given themselves 2 years to do it, but how do they plan to achieve this goal? Well, Philip Laffer, one of the company's winemakers, told us there are several ways in the vineyard to address the balance between the development of sugar and flavour. Using less nitrogen, delaying irrigation until the vines are stressed, and even night harvesting could help. And yeasts that are less effective in converting sugar to alcohol could also make a difference. Jacobs Creek are keen to stress that people buy the brand because it's an enjoyable glass of wine and not because of its alcohol content. So the aim is to produce wines with exactly the same appeal as now, but without such high alcohol. Next up, the perception that Australian wine has a much higher carbon footprint than wine coming from other countries to the UK isn't necessarily true, according to the Winemakers Federation of Australia. A study shows that a large proportion of the carbon footprint of Australian wines actually comes from winemaking and viticultural production, rather than through transporting them to markets on the other side of the world. And almost 40% of the carbon footprint actually comes through once the product lands in the market and the wine is being purchased and consumed. It is hoped that these findings will help mitigate the perception that because Australian producers are a long way from the UK market, their environmental footprint is much higher than some of the competition. And finally, Marks & Spencer is targeting younger female drinkers with the launch of a brand new port style. M&S say Pink Port is light in style and bright pink in colour with fresh fruit aromas, and they reckon it's set to transform the port category. The last time a new style of port was developed was in 1970, and that was LBV, or late bottled vintage. This new Pink Port is designed to be drunk chilled or over ice as a refreshing summer drink, and is priced at $7.99 for a 50cl bottle. It has the same sweetness as Ruby Ports and is made from traditional port grape varieties. That's all from me this week, but remember you can read these stories in full on our website 3050.co.uk. Back to you, Chris.
Cheers, Jane. The news from Philip Laffer, an Aussie icon winemaker, is a good first move in helping manage down some of the very high alcohol levels we're seeing. It certainly is a good sign to see that the industry is responding. And if you like me, you want to know more, I've actually got a podcast next week coming out with Philip Laffer on alcohol levels and how he's hoping to manage those down. So do stay tuned for that. Stephen Strachan's comments on carbon footprint is a bit of a surprise, but I think it highlights some interesting concerns over where carbon counting starts and finishes. In the speech he gave at the Wines of Australia, it is becoming even more clear that CO2 emissions for wine are less about the distance travelled, particularly if it's by boat, and almost everything else that's going on in the production, including bottling, distribution, purchase, consumption, and waste management. To focus on one element is wrong, and sooner the governments get together and create a sensible audit process that is internationally recognised, the sooner we'll have a more reasonable measure than some of the silliness that's coming out at the moment. Good on M&S for trying to create a new port category, riding on the back of rosé's popularity. But introducing a drink for the ladies, good on them for trying. But I haven't tried it yet, but I've heard some rather disparaging comments about it being rather confected, hot and sweet. But I might get a couple of bottles and give them a go at a couple of tastings over the next few while and see how they rank with the various groups of girls. Next up is this month's poll, which is all about how confident you are when purchasing wine. 29% said they were totally at ease and know their way around most wine labels. Good on you. I must admit, I find them a bit confusing and I've spent a lot of time looking at them. 34%, most of the time they're pretty comfortable, but would like to know more. I put myself in that category as well, and that's quite a big grouping there. 20% say that I get by, although I wish wine was easier to understand. And 17% are not at all confident and stick to what they know or leave it to someone else to decide. I thought 29% of wine drinkers who are comfortable buyers. This was a bit surprising given the huge and frankly quite confusing array of wines available. But another way to look at it is that 71% want to know more or are completely opting out of purchasing wine because it's too hard. Wine still looks to me like an industry that needs more education, but something to think about is, for me the question is, does it actually need to be this confusing? If you look at, say, the electricity or gas markets, they've taken something that's quite simple and made it very, very complicated. You know, when you go to switch providers, you spend a lot of time going through terms and conditions trying to understand whether you're actually getting a good deal or not. And let's face it, a kilowatt of electricity or a cubic meter of gas or whatever the way you want to measure it is basically quite a simple product. They've made it very complicated. And I'm wondering whether the wine industry has gone down the same route. After all, by making something more confusing, you hope to pick up people who make mistakes and you'll end up with a better margin through their errors. Certainly wine isn't the same as electricity, but gosh, there's a lot of choice out there and most people just want something fruity, wet and fun. I think varietal labelling has helped a lot, but doesn't need to be this confusing. Perhaps more standard labelling on the back might help. In the UK, we have red traffic lights on our food telling us the salt, fat, saturated fat content, and I use them all the time. I think they're fantastic. And maybe a similar system on the back of labels wouldn't take up much space, giving you the sugar, the tannins, the acidity, maybe the fruit intensity, and then maybe a wee description of the primary fruits to look out for. And that would make it so much more simple. You just look at the bottle, get an understanding of what's going on, and it'll help. I think it's would be a lot more accurate than varietal labelling, because let's face it, a Chablis compared to a big oaky Chardonnay, very different wines. Maybe not the variety gives you a best indication. But that's food for thought, I think. I also forgot to ask you guys what you thought of the Harper's podcast I released through this RSS feed. I think it came out in show 88 or 89. It was a bit longer than our normal show, and if you've got any comments on the interview, I'd really appreciate it. If you like the longer or bonus shows that's coming out, then that would be brilliant. I'm actually off to the climate change conference in Spain in about a week or two, and I'm wondering whether to release some of the presentations from there. If you've got any feedback, send it to me at chris.scott@ukwineshow.co.uk. Or if you've got any other feedback about the show, I'd love to hear it. Next up, we have the interview with Greg Hay, recorded at his winery in Otago, New Zealand. This interview is all about the Otago wine region and rapidly becoming New Zealand's number three wine region, gaining on Marlborough and Hawke's Bay. We explore central Otago and its sub-regions. This interview is a wee bit longer than normal, but hopefully you'll enjoy it. Hi, I'm here with Greg Hay from Peregrine Wines. How are you, Greg?
Very good, thank you. Nice to see you both.
Excellent. We're recording here in your wool shed with a few starlings in the background, so you might hear a bit of noise.
Yeah, well, it's a natural component of life in a winery area, so a little bit of chitter-chatter goes on in the background.
So what we're going to be talking about today is, well, Otago is a general region, but you've been in Otago making wine for quite a while. Do you want to just give us a quick overview of how you landed up here?
Came down to central Otago at about the same time a brother of mine did, which was 1986. And he'd just come back from Germany with a winemaking degree and was looking to establish a winery vineyard down here which was pretty much a whole new region. And one of the reasons we actually looked at doing it in Central Otago was back in 1986, there were only 40 wineries in the country then. And there's now about 580, I think, labels.
Yeah, yeah.
We felt that we were on a pretty good thing here because of the wineries that did exist. There were 10 in Marlborough, and we felt that even though that was closer to our hometown, that was actually quite crowded. We decided that we better not go there because we could be wrong. So we thought we'd actually come and try somewhere where there was no sort of benchmark to say this is what Central Otago wine should look like, taste like, and aromatics-wise. So we thought we'd go and try it where no one could actually say that that wasn't a very good example. So with all the confidence of youth, we set up what was Chard Farm back in 1986.
And Rob's your brother. He's a winemaker.
Yeah, that was his his angle was the winemaking, and I looked after the viticultural side of it.
Yep, so that's your outdoor activities. How many vineyards were here at the time?
There were four. And they were kind of what you call more of, I suppose, garage-esque type operations. They were four small producers who were recognised as being the first pioneers, I suppose, of Central Otago, mainly the Ripon Vineyard.
In Wanaka.
In Wanaka, yep. Beautiful, probably the most photographed vineyard in the world, definitely New Zealand. And Gibston Valley.
Quite successful.
Yep, very popular, you know, sort of as a tourism venture as well. And then we had the a little small one called Taramea, which was unfortunately in the wrong location, which got sort of frosted out of existence after several attempts. And then another one called Blackridge over in Alexandria.
Yeah.
But they had other day jobs.
He used to be the most southerly vineyard, didn't he?
Or is he still did. Is? Yeah. He probably still...
Still claims it.
Still qualifies as the most eccentric, but definitely the most southerly. Good old Burton. But but they had other day jobs, and that was the wine industry at that stage, and prior to 1986 was more of a hobby, I suppose. Passionate hobby people, but when we started up Chard Farm, there was no plan B. It kind of had to work, and it was all borrowed money. And luckily, the bank knew as little about the problems involved with the wine industry at that stage because there was nothing.
As you guys.
They knew probably slightly less than us, but not much. And so they luckily lent us the money, happily at 22% interest rate in those days.
Oh, crikey.
So, yeah, so it was a battle, and pretty much lived off eating rabbits, which prevailed in those days. So got thousands of rabbit recipes, if anyone wants any. had a milking goat and a vegetable garden, but that was pretty much it for 4 years until you started getting any return coming back in. So.
And how much did you plant up?
We planted 2 hectares the first year, and that doubled Central Otago's production. So
really,
From 2 to 4, basically.
That's pretty small. It makes you dominant producer, really, didn't it?
I felt king of the patch at that stage, but still had nothing to show for it for a long time, but they were just posts and wires in the ground. But no, they were. That was a good pioneering sort of a thing to be involved in the early days, but yeah, it was a tough road to hoe, but good to do it because it set you up when... it was never going to get too much tougher than that, really.
And Chard Farm, I quite like Chard Farm. We used to taste a lot of their wines in our tastings, so I know the wines quite well, or at least the Pinot quite well. Yep. Why did you leave Chard Farm and set up Peregrine?
I've been doing that for about 10 years, up until I got to about 1997, 98, and I was thinking about going for a change in direction, and I'm not quite sure. It was a combination of lots of things, right? I just wanted to do something a little bit different, so I went and got my helicopter pilot's license, and I did that for a year flying, and I was going to go down that track of actually doing that full time. But then I actually decided I liked wine as a product for lots of reasons. couldn't afford to buy it, so I thought I'd better get back into making it. So and I just liked the industry, and also really liked Queenstown / Central Otago as a place to live. You can't live down here and not have a kind of a job. It's about the only place in the country where there's no unemployment benefit.
Yeah.
So it was a start again from scratch. So I decided I'd start again, and then started up Peregrine as a brand in 1998.
And that was by yourself, or...?
It was by myself originally, and I've got a couple more shareholders involved in it now. It was based... after 10 years at through Chard, I had a pretty good idea of what worked in Central Otago viticulturally, as far as sub-regionality went, and the advantages and disadvantages of different varieties and different clones planted on various like slopes and aspects and soil types. So I decided if I was going to go again, starting Peregrine, going to go again relatively quickly, so I decided to spread the vineyards out.
Okay, and you've got vineyards now dotted all over Central Otago.
Yeah, we source fruit from 12 regular vineyards, but sometimes up to 18 different sites by pulling in parcels which become available if they're what we're after.
Yep.
So the majority of them are in the Gibston sub-region and also in the Cromwell Basin would be pretty much an even split.
Do you want to just go through what the main sub-regions of Otago are?
They kind of developed historically. Gibston is... The main four are the Gibston, Cromwell, Wanaka and Alexandra Basins. Gibston is the highest elevation altitude, I suppose, and then you go down into the Cromwell Basin.
What altitude's Gibston at?
It's about 360 metres of altitude. It's closer to the Southern Alps as well, so it's the more westerly of the regions.
Yep.
So it has a slightly higher rainfall because of that, just because it actually gets the effect of the billowing clouds coming over.
And Gibson's, when you're in Queenstown, a lot of people may be familiar with Queenstown because it's a big tourist mecca in central Otago. A lot of people can fly into it as well from Australia. Gibson's coming out of Queenstown towards Cromwell, and it's the area as you're coming out, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically probably more famous for the bungee jumping bridge, which is actually at the start of it than a lot of other things, but that's what people would associate with the area. It's the bungee jumping bridge that started off that craze is pretty much located at the entrance to the Gibson sub-region. So it's a very defined area, which is great. Like, there's no who's in and who's out. You're either in the Gibson or you're not.
Yep.
And there is some confusion. A lot of the time it actually gets called Gibson Valley, but it's not. That's a wine brand in its own right.
Yeah, sure.
So Gibson is the name of the area historically, and it's defined by a shared group of cliffs that come in by the Bungee Bridge and another area down the far end called the Nevis Bluff.
Yep.
And it's, you're either in or you're out.
You're close to the Southern Alps.
Yep.
A bit cooler.
It is a little bit cooler just because you're elevated. Like the other regions, you drop down in elevation as you go down through the Kawerau River, which drains Lake Wakatibu, which is the lake at Queenstown.
Yep.
So it drops down, so you get the cooling effect from the altitude, but you also get the cooling effect from any clouds that have dropped their rain on the west coast side. The clouds still billow over the top.
Yep.
So they just don't stop, a dead stop. They kind of keep on progressing, but there's no rain left in them.
Yeah, they've been pushed up a bit higher.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, you know, if you look at it, you've actually got another area that people may associate with on the same latitude as Milford Sound, quite a well-known, beautiful landmark across the other side. Well, Milford Sound is about 30 miles as the crow flies that way. They have 11 metres of rain per annum, or 35 feet. And they're only 30 miles that way, but we get into 22 inches where we are here.
Yeah, it's quite
a huge
difference.
Yeah. And then you go another 30 miles to the Alexandra Basin, and you're down to 6 inches of rain.
Okay, so if you follow the road out of Queenstown, you hit Cromwell, and at Cromwell you can either turn towards Wanaka, and that's what's that area called?
That's generally known as the Lowburn area, or the Lowburn designation, I suppose. There's vineyards left and right of the main road, but pretty much uniform as far as their soil type and rainfall and that kind of stuff. They're basically elevations about exactly the same as well, sitting on the lake shore.
What about 220 metres?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, and then
yes.
Yeah, it's not too bad.
You must have one of those altimeters in your rental car.
And if you head right, you're heading into Bannockburn.
Yeah, you go into Bannockburn / Kenmure. So you've got two little, basically Bannockburn's probably what the area is recognised, but there's also a split of a sub-region there due to soil type between Kenmure and Bannockburn, yeah.
Oh, okay. And Bannockburn has got, probably in the UK, most people would have known, Felton Road, Mount Difficulty, even Olsen's,
yep. Yeah. Those three would be the bigger known ones, but there's also some other wineries who source some fruit from there as well.
Yeah.
But that would be the three better knowns. Then you get over to the Kenmure, which is on the other side of the bridge.
Yeah.
Slightly less clay in their soil. Yep. And you've got things such as Akarua, Carrick, Bald Hills.
There's two other regions. There's the Bendigo, which is on the other side of the river, towards Terrace Ways. Yep. What's that like?
That's probably the latest one to be developed. That's up the head of Lake Dunstan, so that's probably the most north-east of any of the vineyards. Very hot and dry. Two different aspects to it. There were some vineyards planted on the flats up there, but there's a lot of them actually planted on the slopes and in amongst the hills, little rocky outcrops up there as well. Very picturesque, but very hot. Typically very lazy soils who have never been asked to do anything in their life, apart from except rabbit droppings and not much moisture to break them down, but now they're actually starting to work. So a lot of potential as a region up there, definitely. But it's very warm, reliable.
A region that's not really considered part of Central, but is a wine-producing region in Otago, is the Waitaki Basin.
You were saying earlier that's not part of Central Otago. What area is that classed as, and sort of what experience have you had with North Otago wines?
Well, it is actually from that designation as North Otago. It's actually just delineated as North Otago, South Otago, Central Otago, West Otago. Central Otago is designated as a fairly easy area to boundary due to its elevation and the heat summation as to when it comes on, also the soil types. North Otago, or the Waitaki Valley, is actually in a river system solely, mm-hmm. going down from what are our hydro dams. For those who have been lucky enough to fly over between Christchurch and Queenstown, you get these most beautiful milky blue turquoise.
Yeah, they're lovely colours.
They are stunning. Well, the Waitaki Valley is in there. And it's only 5 years old as a region. It's one of the reasons it was looked at originally was it's all based on limestone soil. And so it's actually planted pretty much on maybe 6 to 8 inches of dirt over solid limestone. And they were trying to copy or just see what the effect was that had on both Pinot Noir and Pinot Gris.
Yeah, because it's a little bit of Burgundy.
Exactly. So the soil is the same, but the climate may be probably nothing to do at all with Burgundy. So it's a very good experiment as the fact on the soil structure. So it's the proof's in the pudding. They've seen some pretty exciting examples of wines that have come out of there, like the Pinot Gris and the Pinot Noir, but it's early days. And
is there anything that you'd recommend that I should try while I'm here?
Anything that's got starts with P, such as Peregrine Pinot Noir or Peregrine Pinot Gris.
North Otago.
Oh, North Otago. Well, once you've had enough Peregrine and Saddleback, if you've room for any more, Craigie Range have got a very good wine coming out of there. There's a wine which you'll find in one of Peter Gordon's restaurants under the label Waitaki Braids. John Forrest has one under Waitaki label from Forrest Estate. And there's another one called Valley, which is made by Grant Taylor, who used to be the winemaker at Gibston.
V-A-L-L-I.
Yep, correct.
It's got Waitaki on it.
Yep, it has. So, I mean, they've done some quite slick things. I mean, they didn't muck about. They got, if you look at, Craigie Range, Grant Taylor and John Forrest, there's actually a couple of seriously good winemakers in there to actually do the best with the raw material to see what it's capable of. So
if they can do it, they'll do it.
Yeah, exactly. And the Waitaki Braids, I think, was made by Michelle Richardson as well. So
it is climatically quite different, though, and it does cop a bit of the weather.
It can do, as I say, but, it's one of those things. If people ask me what's a typical year in Central Otago, it's pretty hard to say, even after 20 years. At some stage in the season, you're going to get a month, which is a little bit problematic, whether it's actually cooler or wetter, and they're never the same. And it's, for the same reason, it's going to take them 20 years in the Waitaki to find out what a typical Waitaki season actually is about. But they've had a couple of tough ones to get going with, and not ideal when you're starting to have some very low vintage. You need to get the wine out there,
yep,
to get it out into the public for them to try. And so they've had a couple of weather patterns which have produced some really low yields, which has been slightly problematic from a marketing point of view, but you can't worry about the volume, you've got to worry about the quality. So the main thing is that even if it's low volume, just maintain the quality, which is what we've tried to do out of Central Otago always. And then the public will decide that that's what they're after. So,
what about frost issues?
That's an occurrence you've just got to be wary of. There's a perception that because we're seen to be an alpine area, like we're the only continental climate in the country, everyone else is maritime, being a stone's throw away from the sea. People associate the fact that there's actually 4 ski fields within sort of 20 minutes drive from where we are here at Peregrine that you must associate that with frost. But because a lot of people don't associate, or that they, not aware that that's exactly what it would be normal in parts of Italy and France and Switzerland, that those regions, grape growing and ski fields, are actually like partners.
It's not because people get off the slopes and they want a glass of wine and...
No. that's a big help when it comes to retail sales during winter. But it's the main reason is it's very hot here in summer, so you actually get like 35 degrees is quite a regular occurrence here in summer, but you get down to minus 15 in winter.
Yep.
So somewhere in the bit there, you can be susceptible during the crossovers between autumn and spring to the likelihood of a frost, but it's just our terrain saves. It's like we're surrounded by steep hillsides, and the colder the air gets, the faster it moves. So it just comes rolling off down the hills and into the river systems, and the river systems take the cold air away down through the river, and it stops it building up.
I've seen a lot of windmills on the way in. Yeah. Is that just to keep the air moving?
Or? Yeah, it's just to help speed it up. I mean, there's different types of frosts. You get inversion frosts and you get sort of ground frosts, and any help you can do to try and pull air down where it's actually slightly warmer above helps. So there's people have wind machines in place. Some people have overhead irrigators, like flippers, to cover the vines in ice,
yep.
Which is becoming more and more popular. It sounds crazy to cover your vines in ice at the time of frost, but it's actually the formation of ice creates heat.
Yep.
So that actually covers it like in a duvet, and you've just got to hope your pump doesn't break down, because if your pump does break down, they're covered in ice, then you've got a major problem. But you've just got to let the sun melt the ice during the natural process of the day, and no damage whatsoever. So that, or helicopters. I mean, we're also a region which is blessed because of the activities around here, well, heli-skiing and just touring and that kind of stuff. You probably got more helicopters per head of population than most places in the world.
You said you've got your helicopter license. Do you get up and have a wheel around?
Oh, I have done. I have done in the past. It's actually just thought it was far more enjoyable up there than with a heater on, listen to the radio, than it was actually on the ground with a frost thermometer deciding if it was actually freezing. So, yeah, it's far more pleasant to be up there than it is on the ground, yeah.
One of the things that's been coming out of Otago recently has been cheaper Otago Pinots. You know, when I first started buying Otago Pinot, you know, you're paying 20 quid a bottle for good Otago Pinot, and I've seen quite recently, you know, some coming in around 10, 11, 12 pounds a bottle now. Still got the same top wines, but you've got these second labels coming in. What's the idea behind that?
There's probably each company has a different philosophy about it, and I can't speak for every other company what they do it, but I can probably explain why we do what we do.
Yeah, sure.
So we have the main focus as Peregrine, and we have the second label as Saddleback.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we do that is twofold. Initially, when we were growing, going through a growth phase with the winery, and I wouldn't call it naivety, but you were probably a little bit naive, that you just felt that everything should go into Peregrine because that's what you were making.
Yeah.
And then after a wee while, you get far more in tune with the vineyards and also the style that you're trying to make. And you can't always, it's not a formula, you can't always go and say this is everything can possibly go into that style to make Peregrine. And once you've set the track as to what that style is, it should become synonymous with Peregrine as a certain style and a certain quality.
Yeah, you're looking for consistency as well.
Because, you know, when you're talking about, say, like the Peregrine Pinot Noir in the UK is probably around £17.99, people have an expectation that to a lot of people is either a luxury item or it's a pretty special wine, and it should deliver something quite unique. And so the idea was that what we'd do would be, because of the seasonal variations you get in Central Otago, like some seasons are quite hot and some are quite cool. For us, one of our main drivers is consistency throughout the price ranges. And within the region, you know, over, say, like 10, 15 years, you get huge variations from one vintage to the next. Like some years the Cromwell Basin's really hot and some years the Gibson's too cool. So once we got to a stage where the volume of Peregrine as a brand, Pinot Noir, was increasing, we decided that you had to take these seasonal variations out of it, because you couldn't go, well, this is a really different year, hope you enjoy the wine, it's still £17.99, see what you get.
Yep.
So we decided that to come up with a second label which would actually take care of the anomalies of the vintages.
Yep.
But as opposed to trying to make a cheaper wine, we actually treat it all the same. So we treat all the vineyards the same and all the grapes the same and all the winemakings the same. And then we don't make the decision as to what goes into Peregrine or what goes into Saddleback until we've seen it in the barrel, maybe a month out from bottling.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go through and try all the barrels individually and go, okay, well, this one's a Peregrine-style barrel. It's dark fruits. It's plums, cherries and blueberries. This one's more the raspberry, strawberry direction. It goes into the Saddleback style. But it allows you to maintain the integrity of both labels and keep them at different price points,
yep,
without actually expecting the consumers to play Russian roulette with their money.
Some people like the idea, you know, they say a wine is a sense of place and time,
mm-hmm,
particularly at the higher end, people accept a certain level of variation from year to year as long as the quality is there.
Yep, I totally agree, and I fully understand their philosophy, but for me, it was more about consistency. I mean, they are still getting an essence of what Central Otago is all about. Like these, for example, we're talking Pinot Noir here. Those Pinot Noirs exude Central Otago under both those labels, the Peregrine and the Saddleback, But what I am guaranteeing is that I won't give them a wallop of a different seasonal variation where they go, that wasn't what I expected.
Yep.
And that's what you can get. Like, to me, some years the Cromwell Basin can be so hot you end up with almost like, it's just a power. You end up with a power, such a powerful wine, but you end up with none of the elegance and the finesse that you can get out of the Gibson.
Yep.
And then some years the Gibson can be too cool. So you'll need to pull more of the sort of ripe spectrum out of the Cromwell Basin. But the Gibson has a characteristic on its own that just adds a certain amount of elegance to the wine. So the seasonal variation for me has a far greater impact than the effect of one site. So people can say, oh, I really like this idea of trying the wines off that site, you know, but the seasonal variation has a far greater impact than the actual soil and the climate will.
What about regions like Bendigo where they are quite hot? I've seen people growing Serra down there, which is, you know, quite reasonably unusual grape for Otago.
Yeah, I think people are just trying to experiment. I mean, with these new varieties, a little bit of Syrah's gone in. I think there's a little bit of Viognier going in. There's a little bit of the
bit of Grüneveltner.
Yep, they're trying a few things. But yeah, I think one of the best things that happened to Central Otago is we latched onto Pinot Noir first.
Yep,
that was the one we tried and it worked. We would struggle. Well, we wouldn't struggle. We can't do Cabernet. Merlot.
Yeah. Well, Blackridge have tried.
They have tried. And there's a few other people tried Merlot and that kind of stuff down here. So we never actually butchered ourselves as a red wine producing region apart from Pinot Noir.
Yeah.
Because that would have set us back a long, long way trying to actually find out what worked. We just hit it on the head at a perfect time that people were discovering Pinot Noir domestically and internationally. And so people never really tried Central Otago Cabernet Sauvignon or Central Otago Merlot, and that's a disgusting wine. That's exactly what I thought they'd make down there because it's too cold and too frosty.
Yeah, sure.
We just hit it at the right pace, making really approachable, easy drinking, perfumed, aromatic Pinot Noir that people went, that's a really good example of a sweet, ripe, sweet fruit.
What sort of alcohol levels are you getting at the Gibson? Because I've noticed some of the Pinots, you know, they're at 14%. They're quite big alcohol wines.
Yeah, no, they are, and I think that's more of a factor of age of the vines for me. For example, the Peregrine Pinot Noirs probably 2 or 3 years ago were probably 14.5% alcohol, but because when the vines were younger, you almost needed that to actually get them physiologically ripe, you had to get that flavour spectrum. And so like 3 years later, we're already down to 13.5%,
13%. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so they're on their way down as the vines get older.
So if I'm looking at a Otago Pinot and I see the alcohol level's quite high, does that mean it's probably going to be a younger wine, or just could it be just a seasonal variation?
I would say it could be possibly to do with a younger vine, or it could be a winemaking thing, but I would have thought it was actually more of a younger vine methodology, or it could be a cooler season. But you know, the problem here is actually not getting the vines ripe, they're not getting the grapes ripe. I mean, it's actually getting them ripe at the right pace.
Yeah.
Like some years we actually start picking before Hawke's Bay does, and they're actually, and in other years we'll be 4 weeks behind them.
Oh, okay.
So it's the pace of that ripening occurs, and that's why I like to have the vineyards spread out, you know, different sub-regions, because it just gives that ability to blend depending on the season.
All right, I think we'll wrap it up there, Greg. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks very much for the interview.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. I know I'm a big fan of Otago wine, but given I'm from Otago, that's understandable. Next week, we're going to be looking at something completely different. I'm talking with Philip Laffer. He's the senior winemaker at Jacobs Creek, and we're going to be talking about alcohol levels. So until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.